You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
And welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 186, and I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, today I have on the show Jake Farwarden back again. Finally, it's been a long time. But Jake is on to talk about something, I mean, it's kind of a sensitive topic. I guess a little bit of a content warning. It does involve a discussion of some of the sexual abuse charges against Catholic priests in Australia. But don't worry, we don't, it's not, you know, gory or anything. There's not, we don't go into detail on it or anything, but that is the topic. And Jake is here for a couple interesting issues and things he's going to talk to us about. One, kind of give us the background on the Cardinal Pell situation. So that's one thing. And then also, as a result of that, there's a really interesting ethical question that Jake wanted to explore and talk to us about, because people, and certain actually very powerful people in Australia, wrote kind of character references for Cardinal Pell. And it turns out that back when Jake was a Catholic, a similar thing happened to him. I'll let him tell it, but very interesting ethical question. So all that plus a little more. We also talk about, you know, what do we do with the be it the art, be it the whatever it is, the good things that bad people have created and that maybe were important to us. We delve into that a bit at the end. So really fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Here you go. Here's Jake Farwarden. Hello, dear listeners. It's Jake again. Oh, man, it's been too long, Jake. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, working hard as ever. I feel like the incredible shrinking man in some cases. I'm just shattered, you know.
Yeah.
Constantly working. I've found that there are levels beyond workaholic.
Oh, great discovery you've made.
I'm sure you've hit them as well. So just to sort of frame the discussion, I suppose, I really wanted to have this discussion with you, Thomas, for a couple of reasons. Number one is my show is not really geared for that anymore. I don't like perhaps having those long-form conversations unless I've got somebody to ask the questions, which really brings me to part number two, is you are renowned as one of those, you know, tremendous interviewers, and I've always appreciated your style of question asking, very logical. So I really wanted to have this discussion with you personally because the events are horrific, but really there's several sides to them. Again, just as part of the frame, at no point in this discussion will I be defending A, the Catholic Church, or B, the perpetrators of crimes. And I just want to make that very clear from the outset, because I do want to add a little bit of nuance, not to the crimes, not to the allegations or to the people, but more to some of the mitigating circumstances, specifically around character references. So I hope that sort of prefaces everything that I'm about to say, because I'm sure that if I didn't say that, I might be accused of, you know, perhaps trying to defend the undefendable. And I want to make that very clear that I cannot, will not, and certainly would not propose or purport to defend the undefendable.
Right.
So with that said, there's a convergence of circumstances around here at the moment. Number one is we have just very recently had a royal commission. So we have these in Commonwealth countries where essentially either a high court judge, a QC, a Queen's Counsel, so the highest of the high-level judges, or often it's a former politician. Anyway, somebody very high on the rung of the political spectrum or legal profession will run a commission and an inquiry, a very broad-ranging inquiry into a thing. And the Royal Commission in this case was a Royal Commission into Institutionalized Abuse of Children. And it looked at many different religions and religious organizations, charity organizations. Among many organizations, the Catholic Church was found to be culpable of many cases of not just institutionalized pedophilia, rape, and other unspeakable acts, but also covering it up. The church did have some redeeming factors as part of the findings. One of those was that I think it was in the mid-90s, Archbishop, at the time, George Pell, led an inquiry that led to some actions. It was referred to as the, I think it was the Melbourne solution. I'm sorry, I didn't have it in front of me, but essentially the Melbourne solution, the Melbourne doctrine, was a way of moving forward around allegations of sexual abuse against children. It was heavily criticized by the public as essentially A, not going far enough, and B, essentially protecting the church against litigation into the future. But it was praised by politicians of the day and certainly within the church for cementing a way forward, essentially making it very clear that when allegations are made, this is the way they should be handled. It still remained very closeted, so all of the communication should remain within the four walls of a church, or the confessional, as it were. But it did enable some amount of out-of-court settlements for allegations, and it did essentially cement a way forward for the Catholic Church in cases of child sex abuse.
But did it involve actually getting rid of these priests, or just because there's been so many problems with this, and I'm imagining it's likely the same there as it has been here. I mean, the Catholic Church, it seems pretty, it's amazing that it seems to happen everywhere. So obviously there's a bigger problem than just like a few bad apples. But this behavior of having it happen, keeping it covered up, and then just shuffling priests around, you know, was that something that was happening there too?
It certainly did happen. I will be speaking in a little bit about a case of where it did happen. The premise that was set up with this solution was that it should no longer happen.
Okay.
But certainly it continued to. I suppose the issue that the Catholic Church grappled with, I can only assume, is that you had priests that on the one hand were charismatic and popular, and their congregations were bringing in money, and yet you also had this priest tarnished with an allegation or several allegations of pedophilia or abuse of some kind. So my assumption is that the church weighed that up. As unspeakable as that could be, it seems that was the reason that, and of course, declining priest numbers, etc. There were many situations in which they did that. But this solution tried to remove that premise of shuffling priests around where they went to reoffend. But I will be speaking of a case where that didn't happen.
Okay.
Yeah, so look, that Archbishop was George Pell, as I mentioned, that person that created that solution. And he was praised, again, within the Catholic Church for his action. I'm putting up great big air quotes when I say that, again, sort of prefacing it with that solution not being entirely favourable towards those who alleged sexual abuse against them. So he was praised again within the Catholic Church, and that led to his promotion several times over. It led to his final destination, which is essentially within that top ranking of cardinals within the Catholic Church that elect the Pope. It was actually very early on in the suppositions around when the previous Pope, Benedict the 16th, retired. George Pell was put forward as a possible contender. However, with a declining number of Catholics in Australia, it was always thought that or assumed that George Pell would probably not be a strong contender where there are, African priests or cardinals, South American priests and cardinals that would probably be much better suited because of the size of their congregations.
Well, plus the smoke monster from Lost does the choosing anyway, so how are we to judge?
Exactly. Yeah. We always laughed at that. It's such an absurd thing, isn't it? People sit waiting for the smoke to come out of the chimney, notifying.
Yeah,
Twitter
now. Like, you don't need... Smoke, so that's okay. All right, whatever. They still want to.
It's just
want to be all old timey and holy. I get it.
It's just interesting and funny. But anyway,
I hope the smoke at least smells like Kentucky Fried Chicken or some sort of some sort of fast food chain where they pump out the smell to everybody. I hope it's at least very appetizing.
Well, it is in the Vatican, and anyone who's ever been to Rome and around Vatican City, it is lined by beautiful cafes that sell tremendous pizzas and pasta and
now
all
I'm
the
back
other
on their side.
Well.
No, I'm just kidding. All right, sorry to derail you. It's a heavy topic, but just to summarize where we are, you're saying Pell's history was he had kind of. Been a bit of a hero to some people because he came up with a solution that was, while obviously still not where we'd want to be, was better than the previous system of nothing. So was celebrated, was almost Pope, and then wasn't quite for possibly demographic reasons. But then where does that leave us?
So he was given the position of treasurer for the for the Vatican, for the entire Catholic Church, and he was given a position as a he was given a position as head of or a contributor to an organization that deals with abuse allegations, which are constantly streaming in from all. We are hearing about this all the time. Mm-hmm. In the US, we hear about it all the time. In Australia, we hear about it all the time. We don't so much hear about it out of Latin America and out of Africa, but
I feel like it's only a matter of time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's very safe to assume that it does happen.
Right.
But either way, this guy has been catapulted into enormously successful, career heights. I'm trying to think of a way to propose being a priest or a cardinal, etc., as a career choice. But anyway,
it is. It's very difficult. Within that hierarchy, within that system. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he's in the highest of the high. He's number two.
Well,
in the
if you're treasurer
Church,
of the Catholic Church, that's mean that's Scrooge McDuck, sailing down a pile of gold coins every day.
Exactly. He's controlling the gold. Yeah. Exactly. So very high up in the Catholic Church, and then we have this Royal Commission into Institutionalized Sex Abuse in Australia. It finds several people culpable. One of those people was indeed Archbishop at the time, Archbishop George Pell, and within his role as Cardinal George Pell. That's specifically related to his handling of some just evil priests in, I'm using the term evil objectively here, in Ballarat, in Victoria. He did that whole shuffling of the priests thing, and he did that whole ignoring of the alleged victims thing that the Catholic
Church
is very
well known for. But to be clear, he wasn't a perpetrator as far as we know himself, you're saying? It just was in his handling?
Certainly at that stage.
Okay.
At that stage, he was not known to be a perpetrator. His culpability in that case was specifically related to his handling, his administration, if you will, of the shuffling of priests and of the shaming and shutdown of victims of sex abuse in the Ballarat region in Victoria. So that brings us to somewhat present day, where last year, so 2018, allegations, criminal allegations, and a resulting criminal investigation was launched into now Cardinal George Pell, his personal role in inflicting sex abuse against a couple of people in a church while he was an archbishop. Essentially, large swaths of the Australian population did not know about these allegations, mainly because of a very timely sanction against the media that prevented.
Yeah, so I'm glad we are getting to this. You're going to have to explain this to me, because this actually was somewhat of a controversy on the opening arguments page, because, yep. You know, even though we're an American show, there were people who were wanting us to censor posts in our Facebook group that mentioned this because of some weird gag rule you have over there. So yeah, can you explain that?
So look, in broad terms, I think suppression orders are an interesting thing. It makes, to me at least, as a legal layman, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
The premise is you've got somebody who is extraordinarily well known, and if that person is extraordinarily well known and the entire press apparatchik start sending out stories around his culpability or alleged culpability in specific crimes or his direct perpetration of specific crimes, then he is far less likely to have the right to a fair trial. You know, essentially, it tarnishes the jury selection.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an Australian only suppression order.
Yeah, that's the part where I was like, you're not going to censor the internet worldwide. Like, that's not
exactly
going to work.
Exactly. And look, there were cases, I recall hearing of cases where, you know, things like the Washington Post published on it, Reuters published on it, and they are international news organizations, and they were not subject to the suppression order. However, there were cases where I believe news organizations were contacted by the courts asking them to either censor their content in Australia or take down the content, simply because obviously those news organizations do have their sites available to the Australian public, and with news aggregators and you know, services like Facebook, etc., you really can't hide from that. So,
but I mean, if it's the law, like I don't mind if like the Washington Post, you know, issues that are in Australia, like I don't mind if they comply with the law and censor those. That doesn't seem like too big of a deal to me.
No, no, exactly. And I think what you'll find, I'll refer to it as hypersensitivity, but not in a pejorative sense. I think you'll find the hypersensitivity that people were reacting to, which you mentioned in the opening arguments page. I think that related to the fact that, look, we really, really understand that the Catholic Church is, and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church is incredibly culpable in institutionalized sex abuse. And we really want this person to see his day in court. We absolutely
not wanting any tainting of the anything.
Exactly.
Like,
we do not want this guy to get off on a technicality.
Right.
That I think
is
an explanation of sort of that sensitivity that you mentioned. And I can absolutely relate to that. you know, as a former Catholic, I can absolutely attest to the fact that, you know, having been in the Catholic Church, especially under the case that I'll speak to in a second, you know, I want to see the people that are guilty of doing these awful things and then covering it up and shaming people into covering it up. I want to see these people have their fair day in court. And if they are guilty, I want to see them, I want to see what's coming to them come to them. So, just coming back to George Pell a little bit now. So this case occurred. He was found guilty, and over the past couple of weeks, the sentencing was accomplished. Now, towards the end of the guilty finding and towards the end of the sentencing, something occurred. A thing that occurs pretty well in many sentencing cases. It doesn't always happen when a case is before the jury. What happened in this case is exculpatory evidence, or you know, what you might refer to as character references, were written by several very prominent individuals in Australia, and those several very prominent individuals who wrote remarks essentially describing George Pell as a thoughtful, considerate, honest and caring, a genuine, genuinely compassionate person. Those somewhat affected the outcome, not of the guilty verdict. The guilty verdict was found, but it seems reduce the length of sentence that George Pell did receive in the end.
So it's like I think we have that here, I'm pretty sure, in some way. Like, it's you've been found guilty, and then you go to the sentencing hearing, and people can kind of speak on both sides of that. You know, like the victims are usually part of it, and then someone else might talk about how, no, well, yes, okay, but this person, you know, has done the following things, and both sides kind of lobby either way for the sentence. And then ultimately, does the judge still decide it? Does the jury decide it? How does it work over there?
So the judge decides the sentencing. It was, I'm not sure whether it is in fact unprecedented. I haven't read about it all that much, and certainly there wasn't a lot reported about it, but it seems a little bit unprecedented, at least. I suppose there are two parts where it was used. The part that I'm saying is a little bit unprecedented was during the guilty findings. So, and the part that is not unprecedented at all is during the plea or during the sentencing, okay, rather. So during the guilty verdict, these character reference were given to the jury. Essentially as a way to say, hey, sure, you found this guy guilty of these crimes, but we don't think it's possible.
Right.
We simply don't think it's possible. You know, when we know this guy personally, you don't know him personally. You perhaps know him professionally from his work as a cardinal. You've seen him in the courtroom. He was never called to the stand to give evidence. He was never cross-examined as part of this trial. So essentially, and I think that's why they were used, these character references were used during that trial. And they, you know, by all accounts, they may well have had an impact. At this stage, at least, he was found guilty. And probably, I haven't said it at all, but thus far. But I should say that George Pell has, to date, said that he is, you know, he did not commit these crimes, these heinous acts. It probably will be in the future subject to some form of appeal.
Oh, okay.
But I will say, so the part where it truly did have an impact is in the sentencing hearing. So certainly during the closing remarks, as the sentence was being handed down, the judge at the time said that the character references did in fact, as well as his age and his relative health, did actually have some impact on the sentence itself, so on the duration of the sentence. So he's been given 6.5 years, I believe, with a non-parole period of around 3 years and 6 months. So it's not a tremendously, you know, long sentence, especially when you consider that he committed sexual abuse against two kids.
Oh, so and sorry if I missed this. So this was for actual sex abuse, not just for hiding sex abuse?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Apologies. I probably just didn't say.
So yeah. Can you tell us what charges he was found guilty of?
Yeah. So he was, there was a range of the charges, but the two that he was found guilty of was sexual penetration of a minor, two counts of that, two boys, and they held. And It was across, there was one known situation where it happened, but there was several occasions where, shaming was reinforced, where the two kids in this case were, these two choir boys were, essentially shamed into silence across multiple years. Only one of the people who accused him of this crime were able to testify. One of them committed suicide not so long. I'm sorry, I said committed suicide. Died of a drug overdose. I think it was about a year ago. So it's just such an awful situation. And when you think of a sentence, you do need to take into account the premise that this guy is going away for 6.5 years. One expects that he is going to be a model citizen of whatever jail he goes to, and as a consequence will likely be subject to a parole. So he may only be in jail for 3 years, or 3.5 years, whereas the two people whom he perpetrated these crimes against, they live with those crimes, they live with that for the rest of their lives. So it is a horribly weighty. I cannot imagine being in the position of those of the judge in this case, let alone the jury. But so he was found guilty of those crimes, and again, sort of to bring it back to this premise, during the sentencing, these remarks by these prominent individuals from Australia, several of them are former prime ministers of Australia, several of them are very high-profile journalists, and others are very high-ranked legal officials, lawyers, judges, etc. That it was one of them is the head of the Australian Catholic University, which is a very well-known, very prominent sandstone university in Australia. So these are very prominent individuals whose statements carry a lot of weight.
Right. It sounds like it was very high-reaching. It wasn't just like, here's a personal friend. It's like
absolutely
former prime ministers, you're saying.
Well, there was at least two. Former Prime Minister Tony Abbott and former Prime Minister John Howard, both of whom are.
And they were willing to go to bat for someone who was found guilty of child rape. And that, I'm a little bit aghast at that. Did they pay a political price for that? Or maybe they don't. Are they retired? Or what's the situation there? Or is it such that. What was the coverage of it? What was the reaction to that?
Well, I mean, therein lies the crux of this conversation, because they did receive quite a lot of heat. One of those former prime ministers is absolutely retired, John Howard. He is now sort of an occasional political commentator, retired entirely, not just from political life. But Tony Abbott is still a sitting politician, and in fact is very soon to be up for re-election in his federal seat, which is already looking extremely unlikely that he will be re-elected. So this may have quashed any further chances.
Wow.
But this is exactly what I wanted to talk about, because these statements that are given by individuals in order to, I suppose, contextualize who these people are in their private lives outside of these court hearings are part and parcel of pretty well every sentencing. But certainly, I've been involved in one previously. So, this is a long-winded way of getting to this personal story. Mm-hmm. But in the 1980s, there was a priest by the name of Brian Spillane. He was the priest at a all-girls school in Victoria, I believe. He was found guilty, I believe, in the early 2000s of child sex abuse against several of these girls. After allegations having been raised against him, he was moved to another diocese where he went on to offend again. I knew him in the late 90s as a broody, anxious, and otherwise depressed teenager who counseled me personally through some extraordinarily difficult times. I wasn't abused by Brian Spillane. He was, to me, a bit of a personal savior. He got me through some extraordinarily difficult times. And when asked by his lawyer to write a character reference for him, I didn't hesitate. I held him. I hesitate to use the present tense, but I certainly held him at least prior to the time of sentencing, or rather his guilty finding. I held him in extraordinarily high regard. I can't at all understate how important he was in my teenage years, at a time where, you know, I was going through what many teenagers go through, but perhaps didn't have the adequate social skills in order to either articulate or work through my problems. And at that time, I was a good Catholic boy, and I had a priest who was interested in the youth of the church. I was the head of the youth group there. I played in the church band in front of the church congregation. And as a consequence, I got to be quite close to my priest, again, Father Brian Spillane, who raped some children.
Yeah. So when you did that statement, can I ask you, did you do it as, you know, and this certainly, you're a teenager, you're Catholic, this is a hero to you. It's certainly understandable, but were you approaching it from the standpoint of, oh, no way he did this. The guy I know wouldn't do this. I will gladly write that statement. Is that the mindset, or was it something else?
That is exactly the mindset. And I'm glad you said it. Well, I mean, I was just about to say it, but I'm glad you said it, because that was exactly the reason why I did what I did. It's exactly why I wrote the character reference that I did. I could not imagine the Brian Spillane, who helped me so fundamentally during those teenage years, I could not imagine him approaching any other teenager who was going, and again, it was alleged against other teenagers around the age that I was at that time, but I cannot imagine him approaching any other teenagers who were going through similar issues and approaching it with any less, professionalism or humility. So,
to be clear, I mean, were his targets girls, though? I mean, was that what he was primarily?
His targets in all cases were girls, and perhaps perhaps that, you know, that's why it wasn't perpetrated against me, but others. But either way, I found it so unspeakably, you know, wrong that allegations had been made against that person who, you know, I knew personally very well. And in many cases, these priests who have done these unspeakably awful things have been over to family homes, have been part of family events. And, you know, as a consequence, they've built up this network of people who they can call on and ask for these character statements, these character references. And I believe that that's why I was selected for a character reference. I'd spent a lot of time both by myself with him and also with other people within the youth group. There were plenty of girls and boys within the youth group, and none of those allegations had been made within our church against him. Not saying that they couldn't have happened. Certainly, it seems that he was guilty of such things against girls in high school. So he certainly would have been capable of it. But I suppose I say this and I raise this because all of those individuals who wrote this exculpatory statements, these character statements for George Pell, I believe we're doing it in good faith. I personally believe that it is absolutely wrong. It is absolutely wrong to target somebody who knows somebody, who has befriended this somebody, who has had personal, meaningful experiences with that somebody, and has decided to stand up for that somebody when they feel that somebody is not responsible for what has been alleged. Mm.
I also would want to maybe talk about the two examples differently. I mean, if it's at sentencing and someone is saying, you know, like testifying to character to try to get a more lenient sentence for certain reasons or for, you know, I mean, talk about another situation. Maybe it's somebody who shoplifted, maybe it's somebody who stole And, you know, you have their that person's family saying like, okay, yes, he's guilty of this, but, you know, we needed the money. There was health problems. There was something, you know, whatever it is to try to get a more lenient sentence for legitimate reasons. That might be one thing. I think it's a little bit different if we're talking about being a character witness during a trial and saying, because this person was great to me, they couldn't have been evil to another person. And I don't know that that burden is necessarily on you, though. Like, I also think, I think that could just be something that a jury needs to know. Well, obviously, people who are evil, people who are rapists, they aren't the cartoon villain, you know, with like a weird mustache and a thing, you know, like that's been the big lesson, a very big lesson of Me Too and of more of this stuff becoming public, is everyone needs to adjust their priors a little bit. Like, we all need to realize, oh, just because that guy is so nice normally, like, what, how could he have been the one? It's like, no, it turns out people are capable of acting one way with one set of people and acting in a horrible, evil way in a different circumstance. You know, like, humans are capable of that.
Yep.
Like, we see it all the time. And so this is an interesting situation. You know, like, I get if somebody personally just can't believe that their own family member, their own intimate friend is guilty of something, like, I get it. But like, I also think as a society, then if we're the people who are forming juries, the people who are making judgments, I think they need to weight that testimony pretty low, you know, like weight testimony of victims a bit higher than we have been, and weight testimony of powerful friends a bit low, you know, low to nothing is what I think. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting case. I mean, I'm not sure that the shoplifter is directly analogous, because, I mean, certainly in shoplifting, you've often got cameras and
for reducing evidence. Reducing the sentence is what I was talking about.
I completely agree.
Right.
I mean, in these cases, it is the word of one people, one person rather, versus the word of another, and this is why I have such awkwardness about this whole premise. And again, part of the reason that I wanted to discuss this with you, because are we, by writing a character reference, prejudicing the sentence? Are we, by writing these references and saying there is no way that this person could have done this? And you know, I'm just a guy. I'm not a former prime minister. And it's not that these former prime ministers are, you know, it's not the fact that they're powerful that's important. It's the fact that they are renowned for being trustworthy.
Mm.
You know, it's that their word actually, you know, matters.
Yeah.
Are they, in fact, prejudicing the decisions that are made by giving these references?
I think it's highly possible they are. Don't you think?
Well, they absolutely are. Yeah. I mean, certainly the final remarks of the judge in the sentencing of this case, of George Powell, suggested that the character references greatly influenced his thoughts and feelings. Not as much as the declining health and age of George Powell. But certainly it seems that they did have a measurable impact on the duration of the sentence. So certainly they seem to have prejudice. So it's one of these things. I feel that it is wrong to persecute those who are willing to stand up for a friend. But I also feel as though it's super icky territory.
Yeah,
you know, it's one of those cases.
I mean, we shouldn't be more mad at them than we are at Cardinal Pell, certainly.
Certainly.
But I think I would personally, just for me thinking through it, like, I would draw a distinction between saying, I am willing to speak what I know to be true about someone. So if he asks you, you know, if his lawyer asks you or whatever, whoever it is, they're like, well, talk about your impression, your interaction with this person.
Yeah.
I don't see a problem ethically with entering into the record facts that are facts. Like, yes, this is my interaction. It's all been positive. He changed my life in this way. He did whatever. I don't see that as in like that just seems to me to be part of a fair trial, entering things that are facts into the record. The part that gets a little questionable for me is the part where a witness or a former prime minister, whoever it is saying, no way he could have done this because I know this guy. Like, no, if we need to learn that people can do this, you know, like, and yes. Especially in the Catholic Church, a lot of them can do it. Like it needs
not just can.
Yeah, exactly. Do. That's what I mean. Like people who otherwise you think are totally, he's not one of the bad ones. He's just like it could be any of them. They don't need to show outward signs that you might notice. You as an adult male former prime minister are going to notice, you know, like, so that's the part where it's a little iffy for me. I don't mind people testifying to facts of any kind if they're called to do so. You know, that's part of a fair trial, I think. But as a society, we need to realize, especially everybody who's going to be making up juries of peers and that kind of thing, we need to recognize where our assumptions have been and where they need to be. You know, our previous assumptions that, respectable men don't do these things and usually victims are lying to get attention. Like, we need to realize that that's all bullshit and people are capable of this very bad behavior, no matter how they might act in front of you. And that victims don't, like you said, I mean, one of them overdosed, like this isn't a good life, you know, it's not like some great ticket to make up accusations. That's just not how it works. You know, it's just, so that's my thoughts. But so has it been, you know, I imagine this must be a really interesting and kind of tough situation for you as someone who has experience with like exactly this thing. You know, how has that felt to see?
It is. And I found myself in the very, from my own personal, from my own personal position, I found myself in a very, very awkward position of defending people on the exact opposite side of politics who have said and done tremendously awful things. As an example, I found myself defending Tony Abbott, who, famously was quite heavily against and voted against equal marriage very recently. So I found myself defending the actions of this former prime minister, now active, politician in an active re-election campaign. I found myself defending
him. That's interesting because
he did that.
He is not, you know, a teenager who was helped out of a depressive situation. You know, like he is not what you were, which your situation I would put you at zero blame for. You know, you're a teenager. You had someone who was instrumental to your life. You wrote a letter on his behalf. Like, maybe you might have some regret if it, you know, maybe now with the benefit of hindsight, you might have some regret or something, but that wouldn't be something I would judge a teenager for. Whereas a former prime minister is not a teenager, you know, that's not somebody in that same situation. So do you think it's analogous?
I do to some extent. I mean, I was going through different problems, but you know, I've directed companies before, and I've never directed a country. I know that being in charge has unique problems, and unique problems require putting those problems in front of as many people who you trust the opinions of. And quite often those problems relate to social things.
So Pell was like some sort of...
He was a confidant.
You're right, yeah.
In many ways. So that's a long-winded way of me saying I feel that the situation is fairly directly analogous. I was going through some situations. I feel like these former prime ministers were going through certain situations, in some cases. And in other cases, George Pell, again, he may have just attended family gatherings or social events at the same time, and they've had a great time. They got on really well. I'm certainly not suggesting that George Pell was the confidant of John Howard, a former Prime Minister John Howard, more saying John Howard felt fit to write a character reference for this senior Catholic official. So I make the assumption that the friendship that they fostered or the relationship that they had was such that it warranted that level of character reference. But yeah, I don't know. That's the simple answer.
Yeah,
is
I think I would know. I would have more expectations from somebody like Tony Abbott to recognize the weight of the evidence and maybe sit this one out. You know, like that's how I would feel. I don't blame teenage you, but I would blame, you know, somebody who should have more perspective on this and should be able to look at the evidence and be like, well, I'm going to either, you know, either give a very limited endorsement or sit this one out. But, you know, it's again, for me, though, it's just, again, to harp on it, as a society, we need to recognize that things aren't how we thought they were. And I'm curious if you've had this experience, because I remember just growing up, you know, maybe in high school, maybe in college, hearing from time to time, you hear maybe you have a female friend and you hear them talk about interactions with their boyfriend or something. And that's also a dude, you know. And I remember several times of being like, what? Like, wow, that they're acting that way with you. Like they're saying those things. They're I'm not talking about abuse per se, but just an ability to be very different to a, you know, female partner than they are maybe around dudes or maybe around the guys or whatever. And it was weird the first time, it was weird the second time. But after a while, I was like, you know, that can be how people are, you know, like they can act one way with you if you have a certain kind of relationship with them, and they can act a completely different way. Maybe there's misogyny involved. Maybe there's something else involved. Who knows what it is? But I guess I'm not as surprised anymore. I'm not really surprised. So I guess what I'm saying is I would provide a very limited character reference to, you know, if I would be like, well, here's what I know. But I'm, you know, like if there's a victim there with a compelling story who, you know, is saying something else, like maybe sit this one out if you're Tony Abbott. That's what I'm saying. Sit it out.
Yeah, look, the big thing is I don't at all disagree with you. I think that is probably the politically savvy way to approach it. Certainly from the position of somebody
who's facing
re-election.
It also might just be the right thing to do, though. You don't think it's...
Well, that's the other side of it, because the premise here is I make an assumption that somebody who is about to be up for re-election, who is potentially facing a big defeat to Tony Abbott means, you know, he loses his seat of over 20 years. That's a massive thing. He's still in his political prime, even though he's an awful... you know, suck bag of a human being from my perspective.
And just to clarify, does it seem to be entirely on the back of this issue, or was there like he already unpopular and going to lose, or what do you think is the breakdown there?
This has not changed my opinion of him.
No. I mean, for the voters, like for the numbers, for the polling.
Oh, no. Us finding out about him being a character reference referee for George Pell happened last week. Okay. So, and he's been failing in the polls for what seems to be months.
So it could have been losing for, so he's losing for other reasons, most likely. Like
exactly.
It's not as, okay.
Exactly. But, and that's why I say, you know, to add insult to injury would be a politically suicidal act, I would assume. So I make the assumption in good faith that Tony Abbott has weighed up the fact that this will do him political damage, and yet here is somebody who has meant personally a lot to him in one shape or another. Here is somebody who has perhaps provided advice to him when he badly needed it, and as a consequence, he is repaying that side of the friendship and standing up for him in a politically extraordinarily awkward position. So on the face of that, I would suggest that I would put myself in the same realm as Tony Abbott in defending this person. And suggest that we are, you know, our situations are probably directly analogous. Again, I'm just a guy and he's a, you know, federal politician. But we were both Catholics. We both knew somebody. That somebody in one way or another helped us through, you know, difficult situations, and it was potentially harmful for us to stand up for those people.
Can I ask you this?
When allegations were made,
did you see the Sarah Silverman monologue she did about Louis C.K.?
No,
I would recommend you check that out. It's very interesting because this is a very important wider theme of Me Too, you know, of what do you do when somebody, you know, is, you know, accused of something or turns out they do something. And all I can say is maybe check out that Sarah Silverman monologue, just Google it, you know, pull it up on YouTube. It's not very long, but she talked about what, you know, for what it meant for her to have somebody that she, like a dear friend, somebody she loved, be accused of this stuff. And I think she did it in a way that a lot of people got a lot out of. So I would just set that as a recommendation and, you know, check it out. And people listening, maybe check it out if you haven't. Because that's, you know, it's really tough. Like I don't, you know, obviously I wouldn't blame you as much anywhere near anywhere near as much as I might blame Abbott. And I would, you know, and I wouldn't blame Abbott as much as Pell himself, you know, like, so it's varying levels of moral responsibility, of course, but I still lean toward, you ought to recognize the weight of the evidence here and update your prior assumptions about what people are capable of is what I would say.
I completely concur. I mean, I completely agree with you, Thomas. The fact is, were I given my time again, knowing now, you know, how, knowing now, I mean, we as character references do not get to see the weight of the evidence. You know, we often, I mean, certainly in my case, I had no idea of the allegations.
I guess that's true. There's a question of timing and information that you have, you know, you're just hearing, hey, could you write a reference? You don't know. You're not sitting through the trial. That's a good point.
Yeah. I make an assumption that Abbott did, and, you know, the other character references, that they did have access to, you know, greater amounts of information, A, into the allegations, and B, into the evidence, and still made their character references. But look, given my time again, would I still provide a character reference for, you know, Father Brian Spillane? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm really not sure. I have to weigh it up against the fundamental good that he provided to me against the fundamental evil that he perpetrated in a high school.
Well, yeah, but I also think that isn't our job as you know, if you talk about justice and you talk about a trial and how it should function, you should bring up witnesses to testify to what they know. You know, it's not, I don't think it's their responsibility on either side. I don't think it's their responsibility for any individual witness to have a big picture of all the evidence and then adjust their testimony accordingly. I think they should probably, you know, provide the facts that they know and let it rest there. And it's probably incumbent on the opposite attorney to make the case of what should matter, you know, like, well, how much should that testimony matter? And it's incumbent on the jury and the judge, I think, to adjust accordingly. But yeah, no, I think maybe you're being too hard on yourself, you know, like, I don't know that, I don't think that that's your responsibility per se. I think it might be different when you're dealing with someone of that level of power who probably knows more, like I would imagine, but who knows? Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe you didn't.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I would say you are entirely correct around the premise of us needing to readjust our assumptions of what is possible, particularly in terms, I mean, the situation that you described with the friend who described another person who you mutually know in a completely different light. It's happened to all of us. You know,
yeah.
And certainly the Me Too movement, as you say, has shown, if nothing else, and it has shown us a lot, but certainly if nothing else, that we need to absolutely readjust our expectations or our assumptions on what is possible of people who we otherwise know to be, you know, good, a net good to society.
Yeah. I will, along those lines, I mean, Al Franken was maybe the toughest public one for me. I mean, I love Louis C.K., so That was tough for me personally. I've talked about it before, but Al Franken, I mean, I had just read his book, which is just brilliant. I mean, it's just, his book is this emotional, amazing tale of somebody wanting to make a difference and getting into public office and having some public policy wins and working on to help Native Americans, like all these amazing, like it was such a good book. You know, like Eddie Izzard, I just heard him on a podcast recommending, like Eddie Izzard was like, I've read Al Franken's book twice. You know, I'm going to read it again. It was really good. And I had started to think about like, man, maybe Al Franken could be president. Maybe he's presidential material, you know, and then this stuff comes out, whatever, a year ago or however long it's been. Mm. And it was hard, you know, but then you start to look at, you just have to try to clear your mind of all these prior assumptions and look at the fact that like several women, many of whom voted for Franken, like were like, no, he did this. Like he touched me inappropriately. Yeah. And you're like, why on earth would they make it up? Like there's no, you know, and it's, yeah, it's hard. It's one of those times where
and
you
can
gotta,
I, yeah, can go I, ahead. Can I ask Thomas, what do you do with that information now? I mean, I suppose this is maybe a good time to ask this, given that, Michael Jackson, you know, the documentary has come out. You've got the R. Kelly stuff that's just come out. I mean, R. Kelly, nobody's listening to R. Kelly, but and yeah, haven't been for a long time. Or even when he was producing stuff, nobody was listening to R. Kelly. But with Michael Jackson, it's a different story. People still, you know, listen to his music, and yet there is reports all over the place of radio stations now removing, yeah, his music from their playlists as a consequence of the three-part documentary that just came out. What do you do with the information now that those allegations of Al Franken have gone public? What do you do with the emotions that have been stirred within you around, you know, again, what you described as a, you know, a brilliant book? And the reason I asked that question is I struggle with that question of, I knew this guy, mm-hmm, I knew this priest who did amazing, you know, he helped me through an extraordinarily difficult period in my life. And yet he did these awful things. How can I reconcile that good that I knew of with the evil? I mean, do I discard the good? What do we, I mean, how?
Well, what would that even mean for you? I mean, the good has been done, right? I mean, are you going to go back to a teenage depressed state? I hope not. no, I mean, it's obviously people are capable.
Time travel.
I think it's a case by case thing. I think with Franken, I'm obviously not putting him forward him as a president anymore. Like, you know, I'm not, that's kind of done. There are a ton of lessons from the book that I'm glad I've learned, but I'm not, you know, like I'm not going to recommend it to anybody, you know, like it's, and with Michael Jackson, I'm not the biggest Michael Jackson fan, but I don't think you can make anybody else act a certain way. You know, like I'm not going to, if Michael Jackson is on your Spotify and you're listening to it, I'm not going to say like, how dare you, you know, but like you can make the choice for yourself. You can be like, I just am not comfortable ever listening to him again. And that's totally valid. Or you can say, yes, I know he's horrible, but just like, I don't know, Wagner or something, like just like a lot of people we know throughout history who made good art were horrible, I still want to appreciate the art. I don't blame people on either end of that decision tree. I just think that what bothers me is when people try to make the choice for other people too much.
Yep.
But I don't even blame radio stations for taking it off there. That's fine. I still think that's within their right, but you can still get the music somewhere. Like you don't need to be deleting it from other people's phones or something. Like that's their choice if they want to do it. So I don't know. It's a tricky thing.
Well, I'll tell you the resolution that I came to. I mean, look, my issues with teenage depression were you know, pretty situational. At that stage, I lost three family members pretty well one after the other over the course of a year. So I was pretty damn low. But you know, so am I going to go through that again? Who knows? But the thing that I take away, you know, the resolution that I suppose I take away from this or any similar situation is the art's there.
Mm-hmm.
The net good to society is there. Whomever perpetrated it, whomever, you know, put it out into the world, they were just, you know, and they were just the conduit at the time. The you know, the good little bits of and pieces that you got out of a book, you know, the few extraordinarily well-written sentences that seemed to spark some form of inspiration in you, you know, they're just words on a page, but they meant something to you regardless of who put them forward. I think it's okay to feel okay about whatever was created, even though the creator was just not great.
Yeah. And again, it's personal and it's situational. Depends on, because like I love, you know, I'll confess to it, I love Bill Cosby's old stand-ups. Like there's something about him that was always so funny and like charming and like, good timey to me. And then you find out he's just, you know, an absolute monster. And he's somebody who I'm like, nah, I'm done with, I'm not watching those stand-ups anymore. I'm not listening to whatever. Like, that's too far. I just don't even want to hear about him. I don't want to see him. I don't want, you know. It's just, there's different levels to it, you know. And I also think that part of it is possibly, not all of it, but part of it, I think, is adjusting our new societal norms, hopefully. Like, we have new norms. Because when Me Too happens and we're starting to hold people accountable for stuff that we didn't used to, there's going to be that transitional phase. Whereas hopefully if new expectations are set, which should have been there all along, by the way, mind you, but like if they're set and understood more widely, then you don't run into that situation as many times, you know, like if people are going to be outed right away, rather than like, oh, after, you know, 30 years of Cosby, whatever it was, however many decades before it was finally made significantly public what he did. If we don't live in that stage anymore, we live in an era, hopefully, where bad people are outed right away and they're going to face the consequences right away, then I don't know that we'll have that situation as much going forward. But who knows? I mean, there's always going to be people who are good at hiding, you know, and good at hiding who they really are. So who knows?
It's too true. So I wanted to put forward that it's probably wrong to blame those people who are providing a character reference for somebody who meant something to them. And I think you put it rather eloquently. It's not wrong to present facts, particularly in a court of law. If you're called forward to provide facts, it's not wrong to provide facts. They were providing facts of their relationship with a particular person, and that person was found guilty of really awful things. But should they be held accountable for, you know, essentially putting forward those facts? No, I don't think so. And I also don't think it's right to lambast them for doing exactly that. I mean, we're discussing that at the very lowest level, at the very base level, but really I don't think it is right to hold somebody accountable for presenting facts in a way that they know to be true.
And I mean, I agree. I also think, you know, it might be a little different in the Pell situation. I would maybe expect a little more from those people who should have access to better information, but maybe the blame, who knows, maybe the blame is with the judge. Like if a judge, like what we saw with, I don't know if you heard about the Manafort stuff we went through. I mean, if a judge is so biased that, and especially, you know, I'll speak to the US situation where when judges have discretion and they all of a sudden engage their empathy modules when it comes to white swimmers, you know, or something like that, that one asshole rape case where they give him a super light sentence because always he's just a kid with his life in front of him. And then they don't apply the same standards when it's a black kid who got caught with a little weed or something. That's a horrible problem in and of itself. But it might be that it's, you know, if the judge is in these situations, Judge Ellis, I think for Manafort, if they're being way too lenient for, you know, reasons of bias, like it's their fault. Like I don't put that component of it necessarily on the witness. It's more on a judge who should know better than to give a far too lenient sentence. But, uh, But, you know, again, case by case, and things are always complicated, but that's how I would feel about that in general.
Yeah, I think that's remarkably eloquent in an otherwise unfortunate situation.
Thanks for coming on and talking about that. I mean, I know it can't have been easy, and also for giving us a little more background on the situation there in Australia. But I know that that's a tough situation to have happened to you at that time, especially. I can only imagine, you know, how damaging that must have felt at the time. But thanks for coming on and talking about it. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Thomas. Thanks again for having me on.
Hey, toss out where people should find you, all the different places, if you want to find more Jake, which I highly recommend.
Well, so I suppose as I prefaced in the beginning of the show, I run a game show-like podcast where we discuss news, current affairs, and tremendous things that are happening around the globe in a game show-type format. Put out usually 2 episodes a week. One episode essentially sliced into 2, separated across the course of a week. You can find it on any podcast aggregator as iFriends. The letter I and the word friends, or otherwise patreon.com/iFriends.
All right. Thanks so much, Jake. It's good to talk to you. I love you, buddy, and appreciate you coming on.
Love you too. Cheers.
Interesting stuff. I'd be curious to hear what you think about Jake's particular ethical question. You know, what would you do in that situation? I think you can play with the variables a lot. You know, if you don't know the details, maybe someone's lawyer just reaches out to you and is like, hey, can you give a character reference? Maybe you don't even know what it's for. Who knows what the details are, but you can fiddle with the hypothetical knobs and dials there. And it's interesting to think about. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. Make sure to check out the voicemail number in the show notes. It should be there every time. So that's a good place to call and leave a message. Or you can always email me if you're not the voicemail type. Email thomas@seriouspod. And definitely please support the show at patreon.com/seriouspod. If this show is something you appreciate, if you think it's something good that you would like to see continue, please consider making a pledge there. Thank you so much to those who have and who do. You are the best, and the show is happening because of you. And I will see you folks next week.